introduce Yisong now, who we're very lucky to have here. And so Yisong is a professor at Caltech, and he does a lot of work in statistical and applied machine learning. And today he's going to talk about using tracking data to build imitation algorithms, I guess. But he'll explain it better than I just did. And so I'll just let him talk now.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for coming, and thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here today. Today I'll be talking about some of my work that I've been working on the last few years, starting from my postdoc work at Carnegie Mellon through my time as a research scientist at Disney Research and continuing now while I'm at Caltech on building tools and models and learning algorithms for imitation learning. So the initial motivation for this work was on behavior modeling, predictive behavior modeling, and which was driven by the exploding availability of tracking data of largely human behavior. So examples include sports. So this, if you don't know, is the SportView tracking technology that's in the Minnesota Timberwolves basketball arena. In fact, SportView is now in every NBA basketball arena. And it tracks NBA players moving at 25 hertz at very fine-grained spatial resolutions. And it also includes annotated game events such as passes, shots, fouls, etc. This is a formation analysis project I did with soccer data. We also have access to tracking data of soccer behavior in the European Premier League, which is the highest league in Europe. This is a demonstration of a human camera operator tracking the action in a basketball game. So here the tracking data of interest is the behavior of the camera operator. This is a project I worked on in tracking the expressions and body postures of people as they're watching movies. So this is a camera that is an infrared camera in a dark room that's analyzing behavior of people watching movies. Public spaces like Disneyland has tracking technologies built in, so you can measure things like flow through the theme park. We could even analyze behavioral laboratory animals such as Drosophila. Facial tracking and based on mocap data, and even tracking data where the tracking is essentially perfect because it's done in a purely virtual world. So this is a screenshot of the game World of Warcraft. So these are just some examples of the types of tracking data that's become widely available in recent years that we can now think about how to reason about over. And so how can we use these types of behavior tracking data? At a high level, I think about two different areas. Well, first is to sort of more qualitative, which is to analyze and understand this behavior. And the second one is in some ways more quantitative, which is can we do predictive modeling using this data? So the top part include things like interpretable machine learning. Can we build a model that can sort of give us an interpretable low-dimensional representation of this behavior data, maybe even analyze some sorts of causal relationships? Predictive modeling includes things like, well, given the current state or the current sequence of actions this agent has taken that we've observed, can we predict that the next action or sequence of actions that this agent will take? Right? And we can also think about more complicated settings in this predictive modeling, including modeling multi-agent systems or multiple modalities. And so in this talk, I'll be mostly focused on the second half with just a little bit of the top half. Okay, so just as a warm-up, so we're all on the same page. Will be largely in the supervised learning regime. And in basic supervised learning, the basic formulation looks like this. So the goal is to find a function, h, that maps from some input space x to some output space y, such that prediction error is low on the collected training set. So examples include fake news detection, right? Given a body of text, can I predict whether or not it's fake news? I stole this example from my PhD advisor, so don't credit or blame me for this particular example. Given some DNA sequence, can we predict whether that encodes some function, yes or no? Given some molecular compound, can we predict some real value property of it, such as thermal stability? One thing that I want you to take away from all these examples is that the input space, Y, is typically very simple in these sort of more conventional settings, such as a binary classification or single variable regression, right? In imitation learning, the setting is a little bit more complicated than in basic supervised learning. The inputs are a sequence of contexts or states, which I'll call X here. Sometimes I'll call them S. And the goal is to have a a function, also known as a policy, predict a sequence of actions given as input a sequence of states. And one of the things that's often tricky in imitation learning is that the prediction that you make it can influence the next state that you observe, right? And so the goal then is to learn in this paradigm using sequences of demonstrated actions. And so this is probably the most mathematically abstract slide in the talk. So the goal can be formulated as follows. So the goal is to learn a policy, H, that takes as input some state, which I'll sometimes use interchangeably as S or X, and to minimize some cost function, C. So this formulation captures both reinforcement learning and imitation learning. In reinforcement learning, the cost is some reward or cost function given to you from the environment. In imitation learning, the cost is how well you've imitated demonstrated behavior in this state that's provided to you. And so in imitation learning, the cost is represents a more a supervised learning scenario. And the state distribution so is sampled from the distribution of states that the policy experiences as you roll out this policy over some sequence of states, right? And so this basically violates an IID assumption that's typically assumed in classical supervised learning, because the state that you see next depends on the prediction you made in the previous time step, and rather than being sampled independently. So what people typically do, or one of the most popular strategies in solving this type of minimization problem, is to do some sort of alternating optimization where we roll out the policy. So we fix H, we roll it out to empirically collect a distribution of states so we can empirically estimate this expectation. And then given some fixed empirical estimate, we hold this fixed, and then we minimize H inside the expectation. And then we alternate until we converge. And there's been numerous approaches proposed over the last several years in solving these problems, CERN, Dagger, and its derivatives, various apprenticeship learning approaches, generative adversarial imitation learning, and then methods based on maximum entropy. And the thing that I want to sort of highlight in this slide is that these previous approaches, they typically try to make as minimal assumptions as possible, and therefore can be highly inefficient in complex and structured settings, which is the focus of this talk. And so the work that I'll be presenting today is in large part composable with many of these imitation learning approaches. You can think of it as operating at a different level of abstraction, and so hopefully by combining the two, we can get more efficient learning algorithms. But I won't go into detail about these learning approaches, but I'm happy to provide references if there's interest. Yes.
Measure of what a typical set of state distributions would look like, I really do have to do this alternation. Why not alternating?
Well, because this, in normal supervised learning, this empirical distribution is given to you from the environment, right? And it's fixed forever. And your goal is to learn an H under this fixed distribution to minimize some cost. Here, this sequence of states depends on H. So you have sort of a circular argument here. Right. So typically, the typical approach people take is to do alternating optimization, sort of like EM. Right, a little bit different, but you know, at a super high level, sort of like EM. Okay, so what to imitate, right? What kind of data can we imitate? So in this talk, we'll look at human demonstrations, demonstrations from animals, and demonstrations from computational oracles. Right? If you have some expensive computational oracle that we don't want to run all the time, can we learn a policy that can imitate it to some extent, without having to pay the same computational cost? Okay, so in this talk, I'll go through basically a vignette of five areas or application areas in camera control, speech animation, hierarchical behaviors, multi-agent behaviors, and learning to optimize over computational oracles. And the research questions that I'll highlight are basically how do we capture the structure of these complicated input and output spaces in a way that is both flexible and leads to more efficient learning. Okay, so the first application area, camera control. And so this is the motivating application. So the basic idea is as follows. We have real-time tracking data from tracking cameras. And so these real-time of, let's say, a basketball game. And so the tracking data is typically noisy because this needs to be processed in real time. So sometimes you might think there are five players on the court, sometimes 11, sometimes 13. And then we have a human camera operator that is operating a broadcast camera that is composing the footage of that captures the action of the game. And the goal is, given this as input context and this as the demonstration data, train an autonomous broadcast camera policy to drive a robotic camera to sort of compose the action in a way that mimics how a human expert would do so. So, given this as the input input context, we want to be able to train a policy that mimics the human broadcast camera operator. In this particular case, that's a good question, and the answer is a little bit complicated, and which will become clear in a few slides. The goal is to smoothly imitate the human, and so sometimes the human has imperfections because they make a mistake. These people are very highly paid professionals. I think they plan it beforehand for that particular corner case. I think they plan ahead. Anyways, so here's the problem formulation. So we're given a stream of input, a context X, and you could think of X as noisy player detections. And you could think of a state as a pair of X, A, which is recent player detections and the recent actions or the internal states of the policy, which in this particular case is where the camera is pointed. That's what A represents. And without loss of generality, this can extend to sort of long windows of histories rather than just a single frame. And then the goal is to learn a policy, H, that maps states to actions, where actions is where to point the camera, in such a way that imitates expert demonstrations. OK, so the naive approach is to ignore the fact that this is sort of a sequence of actions and just train a supervised learning algorithm like a deep neural net that maps this state to this action, right, per frame, treating with the standard IID assumption. And you get a result that looks like this, right? So the black line is the ground truth, so the x-axis is the time, and the y-axis is the pan angle of the broadcast camera. And the red line is the prediction of the sort of whatever machine learning algorithm you want to use. In this case, it was either a deep neural net or a random forest. And it looks pretty good. The main problem with this particular prediction is that it's extremely jittery, right? You really would not want to watch video composed by the red line. You probably get a headache, right? And so what's the problem? So intuitively, and I'm being sort of semi-facetious here, it basically takes quote-unquote infinite training data to train a smooth model using only input-output examples in this continuous output space, right? Because for every possible set of jittery behavior, you want to say, OK, I want to correct in this way that's smooth. And in practice, people in this field typically do some sort of two-stage approach where they do some sort of post-hoc smoothing, like use a Kalman filter or some other parametric autoregressive model to smooth out the kinks. The problem with this two-step approach is that the Kalman filter or autoregressive model doesn't know how to model the input context, the noisy blur detections. Because there's no linear mapping for the noisy blur detections back into the model. And so it, in practice, ignores the context, and you get a lot of over-smoothing. OK, so the lesson that I took away from sort of taking a first stab at this particular problem is that in this domain, it's really hard to rely 100% on learning-based approaches, right? And in fact, people do have models of smoothness, such as Kalman filters, linear autoregressors that are regularized to ensure smoothness, and so on and so forth. And a purely black box machine learning approach just throws them away.
Question.
Yes?
Is it clear that smoothness is the only issue here? So in other words, it seems to me like if you just take one frame at a time, you're also drawing away a lot of information. So
you can condition on history as well. You can condition so in practice, I think we condition anywhere between the last 4 frames to the last 40 frames, depending on the application. That's captured by the history, yeah. No. So we started thinking about hybrid approaches that combine both these model-based approaches with black box functions, such as some large class of neural nets, right? And so what are the benefits of model-based approaches? Well, they are well-specified, right? And they have properties that you can analyze. For example, you can look at the spectrum of various transition matrices in a Kalman filter to analyze its stability properties, or look at or regularize an autoregressor to ensure that it's smooth. But they lack flexibility, right? You don't know how to encode in this model a mapping from the game context, which are noisy player detections in our case. On the other hand, black box approaches such as neural nets and random forests, they are, to the extent possible, assumption-free, and therefore highly underspecified, and can, in general, fit very complex function landscapes, but require a lot of training data. Is there any way to get the best of both worlds? And so this is our proposed policy. This is mostly work done by my student, Huang, and a student from UBC, Jimmy. And so this is a policy that takes as input the prediction of a black box predictor and the prediction of a smooth model, like a Kalman filter or a linear autoregressor, and combines them in the following way. So here, S is the state, which gets decomposed into the external game context and the internal state, which is where the camera was pointing. And for simplicity here, I'm just looking at the single previous frame. This thing extends to multiple frames without loss of generality. And the goal is to make a prediction that minimizes some compromise. So A prime is the free variable in this minimization problem. And we're predicting the A prime that minimizes deviation from the black box predictor, which takes as input the whole state, including the external context, and some smooth model, which can only condition on the internal context, with lambda controlling the trade-off. Because we're using squared error to measure the trade-off, this minimization problem has a closed-form formula of the following form. And so you could think of this policy as basically saying, OK, I'm going to make a prediction that's pretty close to what this smooth model is predicting based just on the motion dynamics of the camera, but I'm going to course correct for it using using this black box predictor that can also condition on the external state. Yes? Does it, I'm sorry, help? Oh. Possibly the. Ideally, that's captured, that type of data is captured by the demonstrations. That type of information, excuse me. Yeah. Yes?
That's like information that you know.
So let me just make a meta comment. There's high-level domain knowledge, and there's low-level domain knowledge. And you guys are talking about low-level domain knowledge. I'm talking about how to incorporate high-level domain knowledge. Like, the thing should be smooth, right? That's it. And the low-level domain knowledge are things that ideally should be encoded in the demonstration data, or things that can be learned, extracted from the demonstration data.
Quickly, if they pass the ball.
Okay, that's a single case. Yes, that's a single case. We can enumerate all the cases, right? And hopefully this approach will be able to learn what to do in all the cases from demonstration data. And maybe I'll show you a result in a few slides. One can sort of think about this policy class, right, and try to interpret what's going on. Right, so let capital F denote the class of, let's say, neural nets, little f, and then capital H denote the policy class of the whole policy class. For capital F sufficiently expressive, we can think of capital H as being a subset of capital F. So what does this mean? This means we're actually learning a constrained or regularized class of neural nets. But this is sort of different from your typical form of regularization, which is over the parameters of your function class. This is a regularization on the dynamics of the sequence of predictions of your function class. We want to learn a neural net whose sequence of predictions are smooth, are close to some linear autoregressor or Kalman filter. And what's more, this form of regularization is not just with you at training time. It's with you at test time. It stays with you at runtime because it's part of the policy. And this has implications how quickly you can learn this policy at training time. And so here's our result on the one sequence of gameplay. So the blue is the ground truth, and the red is our approach. And this was trained on 30 minutes of demonstration data. We could also do a qualitative comparison by superimposing the predictions onto the actual original game footage. So on the right is our approach. On the left is one of those baseline two-step ad hoc approaches. Any questions? OK, so what were some lessons that I learned from working on this project? Well, one of the intuitions I gleaned from this project is, OK, if you have a model that captures a lot of the, in this case, dynamics that you care about, at least within some local sequence of predictions, you should let this model do most of the work. And then you incorporate a black box approach, like a deep neural net or a random forest, to add a layer of flexibility to course correct for the predictions of this model as it will naturally deviate from the desired behavior because it's a simplified model of the actual dynamics. And this combination leads to a new form of regularization, which can actually improve learning. So for example, we proved in our ICML paper that we can train in the imitation learning. We proposed a new imitation learning algorithm that's an extension of an existing one called CERN, which was developed by John Langford and his collaborators. And our version that exploits this form of regularization to converge exponentially faster, so logarithmic in the time horizon rather than polynomial. And more generally, can we apply this type of philosophy to other approaches? So things that I've been thinking about, for example, in formal methods, people want to do program synthesis. Can we combine program synthesis, which is a short piece of code, with some sort of black box function to do sort of the things that this short piece of code doesn't do in some desired domain? Or in control, right? Can we design an optimal control with various properties like exponential stability while adding a layer of flexibility using a black box function to sort of tweak it to be more have higher utility in some domain? Yes.
Potentially also do something where you took the standard visceral reinforcement learning or whatever approach that enforces all the NDP constraints and then train something on top of this to kind of explain the deviations from it? Or is it the case that generally you can rationalize everything with NDP? So
if you were to model this using MDP, let's say we're going to condition on the last 20 frames, it will be a 20th order MDP. Right? So I think MDPs are used as a way to characterizing complexity. It says, I'm going to characterize complexity using the order of the Markovian assumption, and then everything else I'm not going to characterize in terms of complexity. And I think in this type of application, that's the wrong way to measure complexity. Right? The way we measure complexity here, the wrong way. Yeah. And so the way this is recorded, so hopefully it doesn't come back to bite me. So in this particular application, we said, okay, we're going to regularize being close to some autoregressive model. Right. And you can condition on that could be as any order as you want. First order, second order, 40th order. Okay. This is actually probably the most fun part of the talk, speech animation.
It seems like that is a very obvious Bayesian interpretation. Are there advantages to doing this using explicitly Bayesian versus non-Bayesian approach? And it seems like it's very similar to just having a modifier that has
So this is related to a, this is has some relationship to an area in Bayesian methods called posterior regularization.
Yeah.
One of the differences is that most work in the work on posterior regularization don't deal with dynamics in the same way. And so that's one key difference. I'm not exactly sure how to extend the existing work on posterior regularization to the dynamic setting. Yeah. OK, so this project was motivated by the fact that If you talk to an animation artist, they'll tell you they spend over 50% of their time animating the face of some character. And of that 50% of the time, it's basically all on either the eyes or the mouth. Because if you get that wrong, somehow you enter the uncanny valley and things don't look good. And this is very tedious in many cases, especially the mouth. And it doesn't really leave a lot of opportunities of creative expression. So can we, use machine learning and imitation learning to automate part of this approach? And we'll focus just on the mouth. So this is basically data-driven lip syncing. So why is lip syncing hard? One of the key challenges is the co-articulation effect, which says that the way you your mouth is formed to pronounce a phone or a syllable is highly dependent on the surrounding phones. And so this is just one example for the phone K. And so simply handcrafting a shape of the mouth for every phone and then stitching together simply doesn't work very well. But can we do this? Can we actually develop a data-driven approach to automatically animate a mouth to input audio? And so here is one of our results.
Because there's never been a leak this size, at this depth, stopping it has tested the limits of human technology.
Okay, so I'll just play that again.
Because there's never been a leak this size, at this depth, stopping it has tested the limits of human technology.
So that's our face model automatically lip syncing to Barack Obama's audio. What's going on under the hood? So let me just set up the problem. So this is work primarily by Sarah Taylor, who was a postdoc at Disney Research, now faculty at University of East Anglia, and my former postdoc at Caltech, Taewon Kim. So the input is a sequence of, let's say, phones. And the goal is to predict a sequence of parameterizations of a face model. And so each Y here is, in our case, 30 to 100-ish dimensional. So a mouth with 100 degrees of freedom. So D could be like 30 to 100. And the goal is to learn a predictor that maps the sequence of X to the sequence of Y. Right. And so here's an example. And so here is a frame-by-frame breakdown of the word prediction. And here I'm visualizing the first dimension of our mouth model, which basically captures how wide open the mouth is. And so as you start saying the word prediction, the mouth opens sharply, then smoothly tapers off, then flattens, then tapers off again, right? And so what are some observations we made about this particular learning problem? Well, first of all, the temporal curvature of the mouth can vary smoothly or sharply depending on the local context. And this is the co-articulation problem, right? So what this means is that we really need a model that can model quote-unquote arbitrary sort of outputs within some local window. On the other hand, in this particular prediction setting, it seems like there are relatively speaking, minimal long-range dependencies, right? How your mouth is shaped to say the end of the word prediction is more or less how it's shaped to say the end of the word construction, election, and so on and so forth. And so motivated by these two observations, we proposed a very simple approach that in some sense isn't even an imitation learning approach. It's called an overlapping sliding window approach. So what we do is we first decompose the sequence of inputs into a sequence of fixed length overlapping sliding window of inputs. We feed that into a black box model, in this case, decision tree. We've also tried neural nets, and which predicts a fixed length sequence of outputs. In this case, let's say length 5. Now, if each Y is a 30-dimensional parameterization of a face, then this would be 150 variate regression. If each Y was a 100-dimensional parameterization of a face with a more expressive face model, this would be 500 variate regression. And then we simply do frame-wise blending, which is very fast. And so in some sense, this is the only part that requires machine learning. So we sort of chop up the sequences into sort of overlapping subsequences, and then we just simply train. And we do so because we're exploiting two observations we made in the previous slide. And so using this approach, we can animate not only Ken's face, who is our reference speaker, we can retarget Ken's lip syncing to other rigs as well.
Do I look funny to you? I may be a chimp, but I'm dressed better than you. I'm a PhD specializing in computer graphics and facial animation. But at night, I'm a level 10 operative for a secret organization.
But we are now on different frequencies.
My speech is pretty good, don't you think? Meu português é ainda melhor, não acha?
So because we map phonetics to mouth shapes, in some sense, our approach is language independent. Right? So we can map it from, we have results, in fact, if you can look at it on my website, for Korean, some version of Indian, German, Polish, etc. We could even do it for Chinese. So here's an animation of me speaking Chinese.
你们真讨厌。 吃饱了,喝足了,就坐那儿看我说话。
I don't know how many people understood that, but anyways, it's me speaking Chinese. We can do singing.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside.
Anyways, there are more examples on my website. Moving on. yeah. Yeah.
Just on the one feature of open mouth and obviously as many other features.
Yeah.
How did you get that? How do you
So it was just basically a sequence of phones to a sequence of, let's say, length 5 or actually we like 150 variables. We want to do 150 variable regression and a black box. We don't care how the black box works. We just basically for our best results we use a 3-layer fully connected neural net with 150 output nodes. One hot encodings of the phonetic representation, like the IPA, for example, International Phonetic Alphabet. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So if I were to make a conjecture, I think it would be possible to make fake YouTube videos that look very convincing within 5 years, possibly much sooner. Does that answer your question, or did you? we're not the only group working on this. If you went to SIGGRAPH, there were 3 talks on this topic, ours being one of them. And there's also work on text to speech synthesis, of synthesizing voices based on given training data. The gestures, the blinking patterns of people. So there are various aspects of human behavior that people you can mimic piecemeal and then put it all together.
Oh, okay. So one of the applications is like pretending to somebody did something, but there must be also very positive.
Oh, I see. So you were asking for less apocalyptic implications. Yeah. So for example, one of my colleagues, he's partially deaf in one ear, and so he in many cases rely on lip reading in order to more easily understand what the other person is saying. And he took a look at some of our videos and said that it was actually helpful for him, for example.
I can imagine that most
people's
teaching like this.
Yeah. You could also build personalized avatars, digital avatars. I mean, you know, if you think about a movie like, actually, Avatar or Pandora or whatever it was called, they did a lot of mocap, right? And so the virtual models that was generated there were unable to drive themselves without a human driving it through mocap, right? Imagine a world where every celebrity or actor, or even you and I, had a digital avatar that behaved and talked and looked just like us, and you could license that out, right? You don't no longer for some Avatar movie, Susan Sarandon no longer has to like actually do the acting; she can just license her out. License out her digital avatar, and then that'll be that. It's a bit. Maybe that might take a while longer, but you know that is something that you know is potentially possible. Yeah. Okay. moving on. So, are there other questions or? Okay. So the next few topics I'll go through a bit more quickly. And so the next bunch of ideas around modeling hierarchical behaviors from demonstration data. And here we're not going to focus on learning algorithms. We're going to just focus on policy or model classes. And so one thing that's useful, especially in the sports domain, is the idea of long-term versus short-term goals, or strategy versus tactics. And so a long-term goal, at least under some definition of long-term, is for the player, which is in green, and the orange here is the basketball, to want to pass the ball and then curl around the basket. And the tactic is, okay, what are the step-by-step actions this player takes in order to achieve that goal, right? And this is work primarily by my student, Stefan. And so to address this setting, we proposed a sort of a hierarchical policy class, which predicts both a macro action, like the short-term goals, and a macro goal, which is the long-term goal, and then a way to combine the two to sort of make a more intelligent immediate action. And so here's an illustration of macro goals. So as the player is moving in this trajectory, the macro part predicts that this is the macro goal, and as the player reaches this macro goal, the macro planner predicts a new macro goal. And then there's a way to combine the approaches in a way to get the final prediction. So the micro action says, okay, maybe I want to move forward or to the left a little bit, and the macro goal says I want to actually move to the move over here in this direction. There's a way to transfer that macro goal into the micro action space and then compose it to form this final prediction. And so we can generate trajectories that that sort of based on an initial burning period to sort of see what the generative model would generate. So here, the green line is the real trajectory in the ground truth, and then the blue line is is our policy generating a trajectory after some initial burning period. And so we did sort of like a blind study in a very, very restricted form of a user study, where we asked a number of professional sports analysts to see which one looks more realistic. And I should really qualify, this is a very, very restricted user study. So we didn't analyze the full range, nowhere close to the full range of basketball behaviors. But within this preference study, plus one means our model was preferred in 100% of the time in the comparison studies, and minus one means our model was preferred 0% of the time in the comparison studies. So we beat a number of baselines fairly convincingly, and we lose a little bit to the ground truth. If you're interested in the details, this paper, that appeared in NIPS last year. We could also do this type of behavior modeling for animal behavior, such as Drosophila. So one of these videos is ground truth behavior of real Drosophila. One of these is simulated by one of our policy imitation learning approaches. And can anyone tell the difference? Does anyone know which one's real and which one's fake? So an expert biologist who studies Drosophila can figure it out immediately. Yes?
I love your help. You showed us like four videos, three were real and one were fake. Then we have some chance.
So in this particular case, the male Drosophila follow the females. And so this type of coupled following behavior is not present in this video. So an expert biologist who studies Drosophila can figure this out immediately, actually. But it does, at least to a first-order approximation, looks somewhat realistic.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that's biologists are not allowed to guess. And so in this particular approach, and I don't have time to go into much detail, there is a hierarchy of behaviors that we're modeling in this data set. So the hierarchy of behaviors are things like, what is one fly planning on doing? What is the fly planning on doing? A charge, a lunge, a wing threat, touch, there's a number of others like biting. I recently learned that Drosophila are very violent animals. And given that as the macro action, can we predict a sequence of micro actions frame by frame that realizes these macro actions? And so for more details, you can see a paper that we published at ICLR earlier this year. Okay, multi-agent systems. So this particular this is a demonstration of one of our approaches. So the basic idea here is that we want to explicitly model the fact that in at least in the sports domain, we have a group of coordinating agents that we want to learn to imitate simultaneously, rather than just a single agent, like in the basketball example I showed you a few slides ago, try to imitate the behavior of, let's say, 10 or 11 coordinating agents. So in this particular video, the red is the attacking team, the blue is the defense, and then the white is our imitation learning policies over 10 players, not the goalie, predicting what the defense should be doing overlaid on top of the replay. And this is from the British Premier League. This is a game from the British Premier League. Okay. So I'll just play it again. One thing that you sort of notice is that the white players, which is our policy class, is predicting that the defense should be a bit more aggressive than what the blue players are actually doing. And so we're training our policy over sort of many teams' behaviors rather than just a single team. So there's going to be some deviation in the predicted behavior. We're not, but that's something you can incorporate as, you know, into the model. That's bounded. That I believe that's bounded. Yeah. The output space is bounded in that sense. So let me talk about some of the challenges in learning such a model over 10 coordinating players. The first challenge is that there are roles in team play. Like in soccer, for example, there's a left back, left center back, right back, and so on and so forth. And on defense, every defensive player, when they know what role they're, I'm sort of explaining, simplifying it, but you know, more or less, if they know what role they're in, then they know what part of the field they're supposed to defend, right, in any given situation. And so if you want to take this type of data and be able to use reduce it in a way that we can use black box methods such as deep learning packages such as TensorFlow, CNTK, MXNet, and so on and so forth, we have to give it a consistent feature representation, right? So the first two features should be always be the XY coordinates of the goalkeeper. The second two features should always be the XY coordinates of the left back, and so on and so forth, right? However, what we get from the actual demonstrations is this, right? We don't know who the left back is. We don't know who the midfielder is. We just get a set of unannotated trajectories, right? We don't know which belongs to which role. And in some sense, we have to either do expensive manual annotation, which we don't want to do, or somehow solve some sort of permutation problem, right? To permute the ordering of the players in a way that is semantically consistent across different games, different plays, and so on and so forth. Okay, suppose we just ignore this problem. We can just order the players by their player ID as given to us by the league, and then apply standard deep imitation learning approaches. And you get this, right? So this, if you just apply without our approach, a standard state-of-the-art deep imitation learning approach on this data set, ignoring the role identities, you get basically complete garbage. And so what we did was we proposed the following approach, which was done by Huang. So the idea is as following. We have a graphical model that infers the roles of the players based on some very basic domain knowledge, like there should be relatively minimal spatial overlap between players in different roles, right? And then after we infer the graph, it uses the graphical model to infer the role assignments, that leads to a permutation of the players in a way that leads to a consistent feature representation for deep imitation learning. Here you could use any imitation learning approach that I described at the beginning of this talk, and then you alternate between the two. Yes?
Do you use the fact that the relative positions of players should, on average, be in some relationship to each other, given their roles?
That is learned as part of the graphical model. Yeah, it's not a hard constraint, no. Yes? I'm sorry? from their, that's their player ID. Like Michael Jordan has player number 23, but that doesn't tell you that he's a guard, right? And sometimes he plays forward, some small forward. Sometimes he plays point guard, right? And sometimes that role swaps from play to play. And it's even more dynamic in soccer. Yes?
Particularly in soccer, you have problems, right? Because not every team has players playing in the same position.
That's right. So you can train on specific teams, or you could train on the just an average model over all teams. And that's what we did here as a first step. Certainly, there are many ways you can extend this research to be more personalized to individual teams. But we also realized that on average, people, the average team, if you train on all the data, play a 4-4-2. Yeah, that is the predominant defensive style, right? And some teams may deviate from that, but the majority of teams play 4-4-2. As this is a visualization of what our graphical model has learned. Yes.
Yeah, sure.
So exactly what you described, a coach telling you where you should be, right, it's called ghosting, right? It's called ghosting. Is you take a replay, and your coach annotates exactly where each player should have been on defense. That takes several man years per game. This is done in real time. We can, for example, train on the best team in the EuroLeague, and we can superimpose the behavior of the best team on my team's defensive behavior. Now, that is not exactly what a coach might want, but that is a very useful bit of information that we can get for free now or automatically with this approach. Whereas if you have a coach to annotate it and people have done the study, it takes man years per game.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well,
okay, so there's two ways to measure how good it is. One is to compare against basic deep imitation learning approach. That's relative to the baseline method you would try. And I think the comparison there is fairly convincing. And the second one is it good enough on an absolute level to be commercially useful? And that is something that we are exploring with a sports analytics company. I don't know the details. They're doing most of the legwork there. So in order to do that, you need a simulator that is physically realistic. And that's something that's, I would say, a work in progress. I don't know the details of that either. But once that comes out, we'll be able to use imitation learning to bootstrap a reinforcement learning algorithm within the game simulator. OK, so the last thing that I'll talk about is learning to optimize, which is focused not on tracking data of human or animal behaviors, but on the behavior of computational oracles. So what are some challenges in hard optimization problems, such as challenging combinatorial optimization? Well, there are sort of two that I've been thinking about. One is the fact that some of them rely on very expensive oracles, which can be computationally intensive or sometimes not available, right, at some test environment. And so you would like to use some sort of learning-based approach to figure out when you may be able to, let's say, skip calling a computational oracle, because you can sort of guess what the answer might be, and if the answer is not useful, for example.
Can you instantiate this a bit more with an example? What of optimization an oracle?
Yeah, suppose the oracle was a simulation, and the simulation returns a number. Right? Like, I have an example in like two slides.
Okay.
The second is in many hard optimization problems, people use some sort of local search heuristic, which can be somewhat weak in sort of very domain-specific areas that you would like to make more tailored towards specific domains to make them solve with either better solution quality or shorter search time. And so this leads to basically a notion of sequential decision making, right? Many of these solvers are sequential. For example, either a greedy algorithm, which is sequential, or search heuristics like branch and bound, which are sequential in nature. And you could view these sequential solvers as a quote-unquote AI agent, right? That is where a state is some notion of an intermediate solution, and the goal is to make a sequence of decisions to find a state with high reward, which you can encode, for example, a feasible solution in an integer program. So that's the intuition. And so, first I'll talk about learning over expensive simulation oracles. So this is the motivating application. The idea is we want to be able to quickly identify a successful trajectory in, for some grasping goal. But we want to verify using a high-fidelity simulator to make sure it's feasible before we actually execute the task in the real world. And this simulator can be very slow. And so the idea here is we have a high-fidelity simulator with some grasping goal, and in some environment, and with some, and we could sense some aspects of the environment. Our machine learning algorithm predicts one of the trajectory has the highest probability of succeeding. We execute it in the simulator; it fails, right? And now we want to pick a second trajectory to simulate, and that trajectory should not only have high probability of succeeding, but in some statistical way be not redundant or diverse from the first one. And because if we choose something that a priori seems has a high probability of success, but is very similar to the first one, it's going to fail again if we run the simulator on it, call the simulator on it. And so this requires a statistical model of diversity in order to minimize the number of unnecessary calls to the oracle. And so there are many possible tests, and we trust the simulator. That's sort of one of the assumptions. Many tests are redundant, but the redundancy depends on the context, right? What is the exact grasping goal? What are the obstacles in the way? And so we basically encode that as some sort of feature vector, also known as context. And this leads to, in the most general case, a combinatorial optimization problem. And we phrase it as a contextual submodular optimization problem, where the submodular function is saturated when we find a feasible trajectory. And so the idea here, then, is to imitate the clairvoyant greedy algorithm that knows what the answer would have been if it ran all the simulations. So the greedy algorithm calls the simulation oracle a whole bunch of times and returns the action that has the best utility from calling the oracle, and it repeats this process for some period of time. Can be composed with Bayesian optimization. It's not related because we're trying to, in Bayesian optimization, they make the assumption that you have a kernel, right, that encodes similarity. And so that's part of your domain knowledge.
If you do a GP if you, for Bayesian optimization.
Which is the only version of Bayesian optimization I'm intimately familiar with. I'm unfortunately familiar with other forms of Bayesian optimization. But in the GP formulation of Bayesian optimization, you encode correlation and similarity using a kernel. So you're encoding that domain knowledge in a kernel. Here we're learning a statistical model of redundancy through imitation learning. So the two can be composed, but they're slightly different. So for example, if your kernel is super expensive to evaluate, right, you might want to learn something simpler. You might want to learn a neural net that... Right, and you could either approximate that kernel. So I'm just sort of brainstorming now, right? Yeah, we could talk offline maybe, yeah. And so the goal here is to actually train, let's say, a neural net that imitates the decision-making of this greedy algorithm without actually calling the oracle, right? And so don't have time to go into details, but that's sort of the basic idea. So the expert demonstrations now is basically the decision-making of the greedy algorithm that can call this oracle a whole bunch of times during offline training. And the goal is to train a policy that imitates the behavior of the greedy algorithm based on features. And if you're interested in details, the details are in an ICML 2013 paper.
What's that?
In this particular motivating application, the submodular function is very simple, although the framework is general. So this particular submodular function is a step function that is zero if you haven't found a satisfying trajectory, and is one otherwise. So in this particular motivating example, the submodular function is very simple, but the algorithmic framework is general.
Okay.
And so here's just one simple empirical result. We have others in the paper. So here is the failure rate after 4 evaluations. So your budget, your cost of how many calls you make to the Oracle. And so if you don't consider diversity at all, you just sort of learn a model that predicts probability of success based on the environment, and then rank based on that, and just go down the list. This is your failure rate after 4 evaluations, and this is our work. And there are more results in the paper. Okay, so in the final couple of minutes, let me just briefly describe ongoing research. So we don't have any concrete results, just preliminary results on risk-aware planning. This is in collaboration with JPL. And so the idea is as following. Suppose we have, let's say, the Mars rover on some terrain with obstacles, and we want to find a path from its location to some target destination, and there's some risk budget that says don't crash, you know, into various obstacles. And given that risk budget, we want to sort of find a good path with high utility. These risk budgets are typically formulated as hard constraints, which converts this path planning problem into a mixed integer program, which, you know, it can be a challenging optimization problem in many domains. And so, you know, standard approaches use something like branch and bound, some sort of local search technique to search through this exponential search space. And our goal is to learn a statistical model of the search space through imitation learning to find these feasible solutions much faster. And so here's just one preliminary results that we have on a toy obstacle course. So this is the optimal solution of a path planning problem given by Garubi, which is one of the commercial solvers. And this is the solution given by our approach. It's not as good. It's almost as good. One thing that I want you to focus on is the fact that in terms of the size of the state space, number of trees, number of nodes explored in the search tree, we're about 20 times faster than Garubi. We train the model on obstacle courses generated from this distribution. So it's specific to this distribution of integer programs. OK, so that's it. So just let me summarize. What I presented today are some new ideas that my group has been thinking about in imitation learning. Initially motivated by the fact that behavioral data is becoming highly abundant, human behaviors, animal behaviors, even now behaviors of complicated computational systems. And what I presented to you are a body of work focused on learning predictive models from this type of data set. It can have various benefits in practice, such as speed up labor-intensive tasks, analyze fine-grained behaviors, and avoid overcalling computationally expensive oracles. And there are various structures, both in the input space and the output space of these application settings, that leads to many interesting research questions. And finally, I'd like to thank everyone that collaborated on this research, especially the people in the top row who were students or postdocs that did most of the work. So that concludes my talk. Thank you for your attention.
I guess technically the time is up, so if you need to leave, feel free. But if there are any questions, we can stick around for a few minutes.
Oh, yes. Roles or actions?
I just meant it seems like your project identifying bias is very applicable to biological research. And I was wondering if you had expanded that into other animals that are interesting to biology.
Yeah, so my collaborator, Pietro Perona, is also looking at mice. I have not yet, one of the challenges with mice is that the volume of data is much less substantial. Right, so we can get, in practical sense, unlimited amounts of data from Drosophila. Like, I think there's something like 30,000 hours of fruit flies biting each other, right? For mice, it's, I think, one or two orders of magnitude less data, right? I mean, Drosophila, you can just breed them like in a much more rapid rate than mice. So that's one challenge. Mice exhibit more complex behavior, right? So I think I think for mice, the approach that we developed for Drosophila would require some rework to be able to scale to the complexity and the of mice behavior. So one thing that's, I think, an interesting question is that I think there are multiple hierarchies of behavior, right? Like, a bite happens over a few frames, right? A hunt happens over many more frames, right? And so, right, and I think Drosophila do that too. For example, for a mating ritual, it does happen over quite a few frames. But I think for more the more complex the animal, the more complex the hierarchy. And I think that is a really interesting research question that you know we haven't really addressed. Yes?
So I think a lot of the kind of simulations that you've done are in 2D, right? And I'm sure there are a lot of like other researchers doing 3D, but for, say, individuals. How do you go about, say, like, you know, say, combining your...
From a formulation standpoint, you just need to give us 3D training data. That's it. Now, it could be that once you add once you go into 3D, the complexity of the system becomes, you know, so complex that you have to figure out new ways to impose structure to reduce the complexity down to something that you can train in a tractable way. But from simply a formulation standpoint, all you need to do is provide us 3D tracking data, and we can just literally apply our algorithms. It may not work that well, or not, or it might. We don't know, but that's basically how it would go.
So the problem is mostly complexity of the
cost of collecting the tracking data.
Okay, great. Let's just thank Song, and if you have any more questions, just come up.
Thank you.